proper asset protection plan would just to be having it layered in. Like, if you think about like a castle and you have, you know, like your own little castle that you're building, you want to have different moats and different layers of protection around your castle. And each one's going to be have different layers of strength. So your first layer is your LLC and insurance. Then as you grow, you want your LLCs that own all your risky assets to then be owned by your second layer of protection, which would be a limited partnership. Yeah. And then that third layer, like your big guns, your big protection would be an asset protection trust, generally a hybrid trust that gives you both a combination of offshore and onshore protection. That way you can move assets as you need to during, depending on the level of threat that you're hitting.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am very excited to introduce our returning guest, Brian Bradley Esquire. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks, Sujata, for having me back on. And I'm back. It's going to be a fun conversation. And I think we're going to really dive into a pretty cool topic and some misconceptions that people just aren't being told about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for everyone who has not heard Brian's previous show, he was on previously. Brian is an asset protection attorney, and he is a leading educator and nationally recognized asset protection attorney for high-risk professionals and entrepreneurs, real estate investors, and ultra-high net worth families. So he has just a ton of experience. He's currently protecting over $5 billion worth of assets, and his goal is to give you peace of mind knowing your assets are safe. So Brian is very esteemed in the space, and we're excited to have him back. Last time we went over some of the basics of asset protection, and this time we're going to dive a little deeper into this important topic. So Brian, why don't you start us off by, and please go back and listen to the first show, and that will help you get prepared for this particular episode. So Brian, why don't you take us through some of the misconceptions that are commonly held in the space about LLCs?
Yeah. And I think that's a great place to really like dive down, because most people, when you're starting out, you know, like that's the foundation. That's asset protection 101. We're going to start with LLCs and insurance. And from there, then it's like this big question of, okay, you know, where do we set these up at? And there's a million ways to skin a cat. And it really just comes down to understanding real estate is just different. You know, like it's not like, you know, you and I owning a business together and suing each other, you know, from an internal dispute, from a business standpoint. You know, like we need to realize real estate is going to be put in LLCs as a holding company, and you're not going to be operating out of that. So it's not an actual operating business. It's just a holding company, which is, you know, the argument to pierce that veil, an extension of yourself. So like there's three big problems that most firms who aren't specialists purely in asset protection, or even just CPAs who say like, okay, hey, let's go create a business entity to hold these in, they don't talk about. And these three are single member, you know, owning the LLC as a single member, which is okay to start. You're going to end up having to do that. Then where do we even set these up in jurisdictional issues? And then a big fancy word, anonymity. And I think the best place to kind of like start this off is just like when you're incorporating it and you're starting out your LLC, what is the benefits and the downside of creating this LLC as a single member LLC. And what this means is that single member LLCs means that the LLC is in your personal name as the member of the LLC. Now, the problem here is that courts now have a tendency to disregard single member LLCs. And that means that you're going to be held personally liable. And CPAs, when you go to your CPA or just your real estate attorney or a business attorney, they tend to set up LLCs as disregarded entities for tax purposes. Now, that's great for taxes, but it's really bad for lawsuits, because what being disregarded means is that the IRS is not taxing your business separate from you. It passes through to you personally. And because of this, they're basically worthless for asset protection and liability issues. That means when you're in court being sued, you know, the shotgun's up against your head, you can potentially now lose everything.
Really quick, because, you know, you just, what you said is extremely important and, you know, an important. So I just want to review that for a second. So a lot of us are setting up, you know, well, there's a lot of recommendation to set up single member LLCs. Our CPAs really like single member LLCs because they're treated as disregarded entities. So we get, you know, basically tax benefits. However, the downside of this is that it, when you have a disregarded entity, it does not protect you in case of a lawsuit from a legal perspective, correct?
Correct. And that's because the liability, just like the taxes are disregarded and passed through to you, so does that liability. It also passes directly through to you. So that's where, okay, you need to fall on what side of the proverbial fence do I want to fall on? Do I care more about making a little bit more money on my taxes, or do I care about, okay, my exposure, my visibility, and my risk is now going up. And so that means I have a potentially higher, bigger red button to be sued and then lose everything I'm building. So I always would fall on the side of don't be short-sighted, because you're investing for the long term. So let's set this stuff up for where you're going, not where you're currently at. You know, like, yes, you're starting out at an LLC because you're just starting out investing. Another big issue with, you know,
wait, really quick. So is there a way to kind of get both the tax benefits of a disregarded entity and still be protected legally?
Not really, in the sense I think of what you're leaning towards, is because LLCs are still what they are. Like, they're limited. You know, like, they tell you straight out, and you can add another member to the and have like a multi-member LLC. It'll add a little bit of extra strength to it, but it's still just the nature of real estate. And so what you need to realize is, as you're building assets, there's better ways to accelerate wealth than just saying, okay, I'm going to have a, you know, and for example, CPAs generally will recommend S corps. Horrible decision for holding real estate, because S corps have shares. Shares can be frozen and seized by court orders and judgments. Even if I were to move the equity and everything out of an S corp into something offshore, just by nature of it being shares, it makes it more difficult. So to get back to the LLC issue, remember, it's just foundational level protection. You know, like, they're not hiding the ball. Like, you're still, the veil can be pierced. So you can add another member to that LLC. It'll help a little bit, but remember, it's still just foundational protection.
And just to be clear, so when you say add another member, you mean like you can have even just your spouse.
Yeah.
Okay. Or like, so you don't necessarily need a business partner. Brother,
partner, like whoever, just, yeah. If you add another member, it will help in a little bit, but not that much, because at the end of the day, it's still just an LLC. Like, at the end of the day, you want to be able to walk away and be uncollectible. And that's not an LLC, but you need to have that at a foundation level. What you actually want is for, as you grow, that single member LLC that's holding your real estate to then eventually be owned, not by you, the individuals, but by a second layer of protection, which is known as a limited partnership, not an LLC. And we can break that down later on, because we have other misconceptions, you know, like to go through. But by doing this, what you're now doing is properly layering your protection. You know, like, your mid-layer limited partnership will be owning all those LLCs that are holding all of your real estate. And so all those LLC tax filings and K-1s will simply passively flow directly through to that management company, especially as you grow. So you end up only going to have one tax filing instead of 15 LLCs as you get more and more property. What you're doing is maintaining the legal protection, but you're disregarding them for tax purposes. And then you're creating a really smooth and easy transition, you know, for fewer tax returns by adding that second layer of the limited partnership. But when you're starting out, you're just going to be starting out with an LLC as a single or multiple member LLC. Just remember, you're going to have some liability. It's disregarded. This is the level that you're at. Once your wealth grows, then you scale into higher level of protection. So just realize that's one of the not the cons, but the negatives of this level of protection that you're at.
Okay, wait. So just to recap, so that next level protection is having a management company that is the member of the single member LLC. Did I get that right?
Yeah, kind of. You would want it to be a limited partnership, though, not an LLC. And there'll be a reason for that later on.
So the management company should be a limited partnership.
Correct. Because okay. It gives you more flexibility as you continue growing for the third layer protection, which would be an asset protection trust. The next big problem with LLCs is just a lot of confusion on where do we even set these LLCs up in? Like, do you go to Delaware, Wyoming, Texas, Nevada? You know, like they're starting to go all over the place, Arizona. And the answer is like, remember, like we talked about when we started out, real estate is just different. And so it really comes down to an issue of just what are you holding and where are you holding it at? And so let's say, for example, it's California real estate that you own and you're a California resident. And I'm going to pick on California a lot just because there's so many people that live in California. It's an expensive state, a lot of money in the state, and people are buying all over the place. And it's an unfriendly asset protection state. Same with Oregon, same kind of principles here on the West Coast. So let's say you set up a Wyoming LLC because you heard it on the internet or your CPA or somebody told you to go and do that. And you're holding a key piece of California real estate in it. What you're paying here is the California franchise tax on this out-of-state Wyoming LLC. So what you've done is just convert your Wyoming LLC to California because you're doing business in the state of California. You're paying franchise tax in California. You have to register it in California. But if you ever have a liability in, you know, issue in California, meaning a lawsuit, you're being sued, a judge in California is not going to be applying Wyoming personal injury damage laws. Like they're going to be applying the laws of the state in California where the lawsuit's coming from, because that's called the legal jurisdiction. And this is because a judge in California or any other state, like if you're a resident of Oregon, they don't care that your LLC is a Wyoming registered LLC. What they care is that it's doing business in California, you know, the state that the assets at, the state you're a resident at. It's done this really big legal fancy word called availed itself of its protections and laws and privileges of that state. That's the state the assets in. That's the state the injury or damage occurred in. It's going to be that state's laws that are going to apply. This is what's called outside liability from the asset, not internal business disputes. You don't just get to take Wyoming or Delaware tort and damage laws with you to other states. So just by simply owning an out-of-state LLC, you have to legally register that LLC as doing business in the state that you live in, the state that you're a resident of. So you'd have to register it in California. You'd have to register it in Oregon if that's your residency.
Even if the property was owned in like Texas or something.
And then you put that Texas property into a Wyoming LLC, you would still have to register that Wyoming LLC as a foreign entity doing business as. Like you have to register it in the state that you're a resident of legally. Once you do that, you've automatically converted it to that state.
Just to be clear, so say you live in Oregon,
yeah,
buy a property in Texas, the LLC is incorporated in Wyoming. Then you have to, is it Texas or Oregon?
The property would be in Texas.
Yes.
You would have to register that Wyoming LLC as an out-of-state entity to the state that you're a resident of. So if you're a resident of Oregon, your Wyoming LLC has to be registered as a foreign entity doing business as in Oregon. And there's no getting around that. You have to pay your franchise tax on that. Same thing if you're in California. And so that's where the issue of this comes into play is you've just availed yourself with the laws and states of the state of Oregon. If you're an Oregon resident or California, you've just converted that Wyoming LLC to that state that you're a resident of. Because it's real estate, you're not operating out of it. It's not a business. It's just a holding company. And so this is where people need to realize real estate is different. You're not operating out of it. And you have to do these legal things to have an actual, you know, LLC, like registering it in the state that you're a resident of, because you're not a resident of Wyoming, most likely. And so these are just the legal issues that people don't realize just by nature of IRS and tax filings and state tax filings. This is what comes down. And this is how these veils get pierced very, very fast and very, very easy. Once a veil gets pierced, now you're personally liable and all your assets can go bye-bye.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really important point that, you know, so do you, from your perspective, is there any point to registering your LLC in, you know, a state that is not your residence.
Yeah. If you're doing, there are, if you're doing business, if you and I create a business together, and it would be probably most beneficial to look at states like Nevada, Wyoming, Delaware for some good tax issues, some good charging order protection. And really what you're looking at with those states is if we had an internal business dispute and we ended up having to sue each other, our operating agreement would be in more control versus the state dictating what they want to do with the dissolution of the business. That's where those states come into strong play of giving more credence to the operating agreements and what you and I decided to create and set up upon those situations. So that's where you go to those states for internal business disputes. And then even from an asset protection standpoint, then you start removing the assets out of the business and have them owned somewhere else in case the business gets sued. You don't want to have a bunch of assets held in there open from that. So then it gets trickier. And then like the third big one, you know, like we were talking about, yeah, anonymity. It's like really weird word of anonymity. And I think the big misconception here is like you go to Wyoming and you create an anonymous LLC and they think that you can just completely disappear and ghost a lawsuit. And that is just completely false. But I get these questions every day. When your LLC is sued, you're going to be legally required to appear and defend it. You have to, you know, when you have out-of-state LLCs, have what's called a personal agent of service. Just to legitimize the LLC. If you don't have one, it's not even a legitimized LLC. So you don't have an LLC. And so these people's sole job, these companies' sole job is one, you have to pay a lot for it, generally like $900 a year just to like have a personal agent of service. Their sole job is to say, hey, guess what? You just got sued. Here's your service. Go get a lawyer. Go defend yourself. So there's no way just to ghost a lawsuit when you have these anonymous LLCs. What they're more involved in is for personal harassment of saying, I think my landlord's a horrible human being and I'm going to go harass their house, egg their house. So it's more personal anonymity versus I'm never going to be able to be required to show up to a lawsuit again because no one will ever find me. Then once you're in court, because you're going to have to show up, the legal discovery process picks up. And then depending on the state that you're in, most states have very liberal use of asset disclosures, meaning, okay, you're getting sued for $1 million. We need to make sure you have $1 million to collect on. Here's an asset disclosure list, list your assets. And at that point, you can either make two decisions. You lie under oath and commit perjury and say, I don't own anything, go to jail, or you list your assets. There's no anonymity in that. And so that's what people need to understand. Anonymity is not about ghosting lawsuits and ignoring them. It's just about personalized privacy.
For sure. So I think those are really important points for people to understand and wrap their mind around. Can you provide some ideas about what, you know, sort of proper asset protection looks like?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, proper asset protection plan would just be having it layered. And like, if you think about like a castle and you have, you know, like your own little castle that you're building, you want to have different moats and different layers of protection around your castle. And each one's going to be have different layers of strength. So your first layer is your LLC and insurance. Then as you grow, you want your LLCs that own all your risky assets to then be owned by your second layer of protection, which would be a limited partnership.
Okay, well, let's circle back to that. Continue.
Yeah, and then that third layer, like your big guns, your big protection would be an asset protection trust. Generally, a hybrid trust that gives you both a combination of offshore and onshore protection. That way you can move assets as you need to during, depending on the level of threat that you're hitting.
Okay. So do you have offer any sort of general guidelines about when, you know, in terms of like total asset value, when you would move to each?
Yeah, that's a great question. When you're starting out, your first thing, like you say you have $0, I mean, you're going to buy your first property, first risky asset. that's when you start with insurance and LLC.
And by insurance, you mean property and like liability, or can you clarify that?
Yeah, like you want to have some renter's insurance, property insurance, you know, like you needed to have like basic insurance, some, you know, like even an umbrella policy would be, you know, advisable. And then you need to also then put that property into an LLC. If you can't afford layers of insurance and an LLC, I would say hold off on buying a property, because the last thing that you, when you're just starting out, that's when most errors are going to occur, but you don't have the money to even balance that out. And so that's where you need to be smart about creating and budgeting for how you're going to hold the assets and how am I going to protect myself in case some, you know, minor things happen. When you hit around 250 to 500,000 net worth of unprotected assets, generally it'd be like 4 or 5 units. That's when you start adding the second layer of protection, a limited partnership, because at that point you're going to have probably 2 or 3 LLCs. You're going to have more risk, more liability. You're realizing insurance isn't going to always be there to cover big issues. They're just good for small issues and collecting premiums. That's where the limited partnership comes in, because it cleans up your system. So you only have one tax filing. Then when you hit about 1 million net worth of unprotected assets, that's when you come in with like the big guns, the asset protection hybrid trust.
Okay. And when you say unprotected assets, can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. Unprotected assets mean, so I'll use it for like stocks. All right. Your 401k, ERISA, you know, protected stocks like 401k IRAs have exemption status. So they're already protected. So I don't include that in your net worth valuation. When I look at how much you have, I would subtract out your 401k. So if you come to me and say, well, I have 1.2 million worth of net worth and 1 million of that is all in a 401k, then you only have $200,000 worth of unprotected assets if it's in real estate. And so that's where we look at what's unprotected assets, which generally will then come to cash, you know, in your bank account, savings accounts, personal brokerage accounts. Those aren't exempted. We can protect those. Real estate investments, your house, cryptocurrencies, you know, all of those other assets. It's just if it's ERISA protected, 401ks, retirement plans like that, they generally have strong enough exemption status.
Okay, got it. So then just circling back to this limited partnership. So there's, you own properties, they each have an LLC, and then the manager of that LLC that owns the property should be a limited partnership.
So limited partner. Yes.
Okay. And so, you know, why does it need to be a limited partnership instead of an LLC?
Yeah. So there's a lot more benefits that you get at that second layer of protection through a limited partnership than you would from an LLC. So they're like LLCs and they have some charging order protection. And I like them better because they have a very distinct delineation between a managing partner called the general partner, the GP, and a minority partner who does not. So they actually think of it like having like a split personality. So you have two different distinct classes of ownership types that LLCs by nature don't have. We like having both a general partner interest and a limited partner interest. And then we use the limited partner as the starting point for clients as that holding company and management company. And then as you grow and you hit that 1 million net worth mark, then we can come in and add that asset protection, like hybrid bridge trust, to actually own that limited partnership.
So that makes sense. And then just before we move on from the limited partnership, so how is setting up a limited partnership different? Can you define how it would be different? Like, you know, LLC is this usually, it would be a single member LLC or
maybe. Yeah. So it's partnership classes. And that's why I'll jump into like, just like very specific benefits of a limited partnership versus like a Wyoming LLC or other LLCs. You have exclusive charging order protection through like an Arizona limited partnership as the only remedy for creditors for a partnership. And that's what you only get through a limited partnership, because it's a partnership. It's not a membership ownership class like an LLC. And so, and that's an exclusive protection order. You also have an actual statutory distinction between general partners and limited partners. So by statute, this is better than LLCs, because LLCs can only do this by an operating agreement. And then courts will then end up having to interpret that operating agreement. So then you're left at the court's determination of what you and your partner or whoever, whatever, you know, decided on. So it's left to a judge's interpretation versus a statutorily, you know, distinction. You have, like, I like Arizona limited partnerships because you have this section, ARS section 29-333. It specifically allows for a limited partnership to make what's called a unilateral withdrawal from a limited partner, what is a predefined event of duress. So what all this means is it's very unique to Arizona, and it's what you need to allow an asset protection trust to completely disconnect statutorily from the holding company during a lawsuit. And it can only be done with a limited partnership. You can't do that with LLCs without coming into arguments of fraudulent transfers. So it's very unique to limited partnerships. And then limited partnerships are perpetual, whereas other states, they require annual reporting and filings of LLCs. You also have statutorily by nature, some anonymity and privacy built into partnerships, because in limited partnerships, they're completely private. You don't list the names of the partners on the limited partnership versus LLCs, the members are disclosed. And for tax filing purposes, your limited partnership cannot be a disregarded entity, you know, but LLCs with just one member, they're automatically considered disregarded entities. And like we said before, that's not good for lawsuits.
So do you lose the tax benefits by having a limited partnership?
So it's an interesting question, because I always think people like really care about using the entities for tax purposes. For asset protection, we don't get into it at all because everything has to be tax neutral. What your taxes should be coming through is like your CPAs and your wealth managers doing like forced depreciation, you know, and things like that for real estate holdings. So when you're looking at investing in real estate, you shouldn't be looking at your LLC and your limited partnership as like offering you any extra money in your pocket, because it's going to be minimal compared to what you're going to be using by like forced depreciation and cost seg analysis, you know, through your CPA. That's where you're going to be making a lot of money, you know, with the real estate, then like, you know, forced cash flowing from there. From an asset protection standpoint, the business entities need to be tax neutral, because if they're set up to be tax benefits, then that can get into arguments when you're getting sued as, well, this was just set up to avoid taxes.
Right. Okay. So say you're having like your offering docs drawn up by, you know, your attorney, where do you come in? Do you do offering docs as well? Like, you know, subscription agreements and private placement memorandums?
No. So like we just strictly would just transfer, like create the LLCs, create the limited partnerships, create the trust, you know, fund them, you know, so they're funded properly, or like, you know, help you depending on the state, like you're going to have to go like certain counties, you know, and like basically like hold your hand through that. But when it comes to actual, you know, drafting up business partner agreements and stuff like that, we're not a business, you know, a business attorney.
Okay. But so you would set up the entities correctly, and then you would bring those entities to your attorney to, you know, do the offering docs, et cetera.
Yeah. And so we create the buckets properly that need to be protected, and then manage the buckets. And then you would have like whatever deal you're closing on, your real estate attorney is going to be closing that deal and drafting up all those. If you're going into a new business adventure, you're going to be going to your business attorney to be making sure you have, you know, you're the best representation on closing that deal and getting that business going. We just make sure whatever asset you have, we have the proper buckets created and proper protection around all those assets.
Got it. Okay. So then what would your recommendation be to, because, you know, obviously I'm sure you encounter this all the time. People are having LLCs as their management entity rather than limited partnerships that are owning the property LLCs. So is there like a pathway forward to transitioning that from an LLC to a limited partnership?
You wouldn't transition the LLCs to a limited partnership. You would just have the limited partnership. Like you would just have your ownership interest as the managing partner of the LLC removed to your limited partnership that you create. So you're keeping the assets in the LLC. That's how you should be doing it. Have your assets put into your LLCs. As you eventually grow, then say, okay, I need to have my LLCs owned by this limited partnership.
Okay, great. Well, that was, I think, a lot of information for our podcast so far. What else? Is there anything else on this kind of, oh yeah, then we're going to asset protection, or tell us about the third level.
Oh, the third level, yeah, is really where all the magic happens. And those are asset protection trust. And what there's different flavors of them. And I'm not sure how much detail you want me to jump in like on this time for asset protection trust. But it is the final layer, like especially when you get into the high net worth, you have a lot of properties, maybe you have a high risk profession as well. I love trust. They're one of the best planning principles that you can use and have. They've been around for a very long time. most people are familiar with the standard, you know, 101 basic level family revocable living trust. Those are not asset protection trusts. Those are estate planning trusts for avoiding, you know, death taxes and probate when you die. They don't offer you any protection. So don't think all trusts are equal. There's lots of different types of trusts. The higher level of trust are called asset protection trusts. They came about in the early 1980s in the famous island, the Cook Islands, who created a self-settled spendthrift trust. What they mean is they're created by you for yourself as your own beneficiaries with really strong spendthrift provisions in there. When you're creating asset protection trust, you have three options. You can create them domestically here in the US. You can create them purely offshore in like the Cook Islands or other countries. Or there's a hybrid, which I prefer, which is kind of the best of both worlds. It combines the best of both worlds. From a historical context of this, the offshore trust actually came first in 1984 in the famous Cook Islands. I prefer the power of going offshore if and when you need it. It's because it's just the best home court advantage. The reason is that it has what's called statutory non-recognition. It means we're just not going to recognize any other country's court orders or judgments. It's still the global standard, even after 40 years, with 40 years of case law all the way up to the Supreme Court. That's just how strong they are globally. What it means is like a U.S. judgment is completely worthless in the Cook Islands. You know, like they'd have to start the case all over from scratch in the Cook Islands, and they'd have to prove a case by the murder standard beyond a reasonable doubt. They'd have to front all the court costs, fly in a judge from New Zealand. You can't take your U.S. attorneys with you there. They don't take contingency fee attorneys there. If you lose, you pay. And so if you're trying to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt, most likely the person suing you is going to lose. And there's only a one-year statute of limitations. So once they realize they have to sue you there, it's probably already past the statute of limitations. The problem here with offshore trusts that are purely offshore, like the Cook Islands, is really expensive. It's like it's overkill for most people. Like, you know, it's about $50,000 to set up for it to actually work. Most people don't have that need and level of protection. And then there's a lot of IRS compliance that you have to disclose your assets with. So for people in the U.S., it's kind of, we don't want to go that far. So we're going to settle for the domestic U.S. trust. Those came about 10 years later. You have about 20 states that allow some sort of domestic asset protections trust with some domestic statutes. Not all do. The weakness of why you don't like it, I don't like anything purely domestic, is they really fail on effectiveness because we have the U.S. Constitution, the full faith and credit clause. We're seeing a pattern of purely domestic asset protection trusts being pierced in courts now. You know, like we have this California case, Kilker versus Steelman, that came out in 2012 that said, hey, you're a California resident. We're not going to let you go to Nevada and create a Nevada asset protection trust because guess what? You're not a resident of the state of Nevada. So we're not going to recognize it. We're piercing it and we're getting into those assets now. And you're seeing this across the board now. So because of that negative case law that we're seeing, I'm not a big fan of anything purely domestic for asset protection trust or anything purely domestic without some sort of built-in offshore component. I prefer a hybrid, which is called a bridge trust. We use that for about 95% of our clients. And the hybrid is just combining the best of both worlds of the offshore Cook Island asset protection trust. But what we do is we build a bridge back so that the IRS classifies it as a domestic trust. And then what we do is better for cost. It's going to be cheaper because it's domesticated. And then the maintenance is going to be cheaper in the long run. But we get the benefit of dropping the IRS compliance statutes. So there's this code section, USC section 7701. What we would do is drop compliance with that code section. And then as soon as we do that, the trust is automatically purely foreign. And now you have all that power of the offshore Cook Islands when you need it. It puts you back in the position of strength to negotiate cases to settle for pennies on the dollar. Once the case settles and goes away, we re-domesticate it again.
Awesome. Well, that was definitely a lot of great information. And I hope that, you know, thank you for going through all of that. I'm definitely going to have to listen to that again. But thank you so much, Brian, for coming on and explaining about asset protection. It's such an important topic as we grow as real estate investors. And I hope you all take, you know, if it's something that you haven't done yet, take some time to really think about your asset protection. And on that note, Brian, thanks so much just for the overall overview today. Would you please tell the listeners how they can learn more about you and get in touch with you and anything else you'd like to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be like, the last thing to get, you know, to share is just do the planning before it's needed. I have too many people being sued coming to me. You're too far down the rabbit hole because I'd have to exempt the lawsuit. So get your asset protection done before you're being sued. The longer you have it without a lawsuit, the stronger it gets. Then once you pass your look back period, it's like the strongest thing in the world you're going to have. So just be proactive. Then contact information, like, yeah, my website, they can go on www.btblegal.com. I have my website set up as an educational source, really, like tons of case law and statutes for people to go through. A lot of good articles that we write just to educate people. Knowledge is power. You know, like, I'd rather have people be fully educated so they know when they're being sold a bag of goods or not. Or email me, Brian, B-R-I-A-N @btblegal.com. And I'd rather, do a 1 hour consultation, free consultation for someone, you know, let them have some good information and then make their decision from
there. Awesome. Well, that's a wonderful opportunity for all of you. So please, if you have a need, get in touch with Brian. And thanks again so much for coming on for a second time, Brian, and going deeper into asset protection. Really valuable information. Have a wonderful day, everyone. And we'll see you next time, Brian.
Definitely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.